Ms. Brennan.
May it please the court, my name is Stephanie Brennan and I represent the appellant in this case, Ms. Tracy Ratliff-White. Ms. Ratliff-White was a disabled veteran who had been approved by the Hines VA Hospital for 24-hour home care due to diagnosed serious mental health disorders. And Ms. Ratliff-White was charged with wire fraud based on an alleged scheme to defraud the VA by creating a fictitious company that would receive funds for providing the home care without actually providing services to Ms. Ratliff-White. In our brief, we presented three arguments for three grounds for reversal, and those are fully set forth in the brief. So I'm happy to answer your questions about any of the three issues, but today I'd like to focus my limited time on our argument that the government presented insufficient evidence that Ms. Ratliff-White caused the wire transmissions with which she was charged. Now, that issue calls upon this court to decide a legal issue that has never been directly addressed by the circuit, and on which at least two other courts of appeals have reached different conclusions. And that is whether, under the wire fraud statute, the government must prove that a criminal defendant knew or could foresee the specific wire transmission with which she is charged in the indictment, or whether it's sufficient that she could see that the use of wires generally would occur in connection with the scheme. Now, to prove wire fraud and to prove the causation of wire fraud, there are essentially two ways to do it. One is to show that the defendant is acting with knowledge that the use of the wires would occur in the ordinary course of business, and the other is to show that it was reasonably foreseeable. In this case, there was no suggestion that the defendant knew about the specific wire transmission with which she was charged. And we also contend that there was no evidence in the record to show that she could reasonably foresee that transmission. The indictment charged Ms. Ratliff-White with having caused a very specific transmission. It charged her with having caused wire transmissions of payment instructions from the Federal Reserve Bank from the U.S. Treasury in Hyattsville, Maryland, to the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas, Texas, as part of a multi-step process by which the VA vendor payments were effectuated. And you know, according to the government's Treasury witness, there was this multi-step process that would occur. It would be initiated by the VA hospital. There would then be a couple of back-and-forth steps between the Treasury and the VA where they verified the amount and made sure that everything was correct. And then after that, about the fourth step in this process, which is the step at issue in the indictment, the Treasury's Austin, Texas facility would format the payment request and transmit it to the mainframe from the mainframe to the Reserve Bank in Dallas, Texas. And after that point, the Federal Reserve would then transmit the funds into her bank account. So a couple of key things about the factual.
So your position is that the government had to show that specifically how that transmission occurred and the process of that transmission.
That's
based on how the indictment was charged.
That's correct.
And a part, of course, of the reason that the indictment is given is to notify the defendant as to the charges against her so she can defend herself. How did that wording prejudice or impair her in her ability to defend herself? Because you agree that there was a wire transfer.
Correct.
Right, because otherwise she couldn't have gotten the
We check. Agree that there was the transfer at least into her bank
funds.
Account.
Right.
Correct.
The transfer of the funds. So how does that prejudice her? How did that impair her ability to defend herself, that particular language that, you know, you identified?
Well, there was no evidence in the record about the foreseeability of the specific transmission that's charged in the indictment. If you read the indictment, which is in our appendix to our brief, it very specifically charges her with causing the transmission of payment instructions that I've just specified. And there was no evidence presented at trial about the foreseeability of these internal government payment instruction transmissions prior to the deposit of funds. And in fact, Ms. Ratliff-White's counsel at trial asked questions you know, going to the fact that this wasn't foreseeable. And I believe that there are questions asked of Mr. Rio, who was an administrator for the Heinz VA, about whether he knew about what the process was and how things occurred prior to the deposit of the funds, and he did not even know. So there was evidence elicited to the effect that this transmission would not be foreseeable. And, you know, perhaps had different transmissions been alleged in the indictment, she could have focused on whether or not those transmissions were indeed foreseeable and presented evidence to show that they were not. Now, as I mentioned, there's a circuit split on this issue, with the First Circuit having held that use of mails generally is enough. However, the 11th Circuit, in a case, in the Smith case, held that the government had to show that the specific mailing was alleged was foreseeable, and that was a case that was similar to this one in that the indictment was very narrowly drawn, and it specified a mailing of accounting copies of drafts from an insurance company or an agent to its insurance company. And the court said, in that case, when you have a narrowly drawn indictment, you have to look at whether the specific transmission or the mailing in that case that was charged is reasonably foreseeable.
Well, when we're in this electronic world, don't you think there's a distinction between the electronic world and the paper world, as in that case that you cited?
Well, I would say that the mail fraud statute and the wire fraud statute have been construed as parallel statutes, and I think that's pretty consistently done. There may be some practical differences, but I'm not sure of any that would necessarily affect or distinguish the Smith case from this particular one. I think that the 11th Circuit holding is really the right view, and that this court should side with the 11th Circuit for two basic reasons. The first is that view is more consistent with 7th Circuit precedent. If you look at what this court has required in a number of holdings that have occurred under the mail and wire fraud statutes, it's clear that the inquiry has really always been whether the specific inquiry is foreseeable. A handful of these have general language derived from the Pariah decision that the use of the mails must be foreseeable, but it's clear even in those opinions that the inquiry is always whether, and it's very consistently been, whether the specific mailing or wire is foreseeable. One example is the Bonansinga case. In that case, they went through in detail and analyzed each of the mailings that were occurred, and then they looked at one count and said that count is... it's closer to simple theft than some of these other counts, but, you know, we're looking at foreseeability, and we think actually it was foreseeable. So they looked at whether the defendant's scheme was the cause of the mailings that were alleged in the count. They didn't look at other mailings. They didn't say it was enough that some mailings were foreseeable. They said the specific mailing that was alleged in the count was what mattered. Also, I think that this court needs to consider the Walters case, which I think is very instructive on this issue. In that case, the court found that there was insufficient evidence to show the foreseeability of mailings that were alleged. That was a scheme that involved attempts to sign college players secretly to agency contracts in violation of NCAA rules. And what the defendant in that case did was he postdated these contracts, the end of the player's college eligibility, and locked them in a safe and gave them various cars and money in exchange. And essentially the mailing was that each university had required verification of an eligibility form from the players, and that was sent to conferences. And this court said there's no reason that the defendant could have expected that these specific forms would have been taken by the university and mailed. So I think that case very clearly shows that it's a specific mailing, the specific wire that really counts. And it also addresses some of the important policy reasons for siding with the 11th Circuit in that view, which is that it's simply too broad to say that you can use other mailings, not even charged in the indictment, to prove foreseeability.
Well, what we have here, Ms. Brennan, if I follow your logic, We have a possible gap in the, isn't that right? Because of this detour that Rio testified to? I mean, this offline method?
Right. That's
if that had been tracked, as you would argue it should have been, or then we would have had the complete wire transfer laid out. Is that your position?
Right. That's the separate issue of whether or not there was sufficient evidence to show the mailings or to show the wires.
Right. So are you suggesting there is a rational jury couldn't find sufficient evidence of the transfer here? This is apart from the foreseeability.
Correct. That is our position. We contend that there was testimony by Mr. Rio that the offline procedure could have been used, that the government never presented any evidence that would allow us to figure out what that meant with respect to how the wires were effectuated in that case. And because of that gap, it's just simply too large to allow the jury to make the inference.
What kind of speculation do you think could have occurred, erroneous speculation, could have occurred that would lead the jury to a guilty verdict?
Well, I think that assuming that, as you do, that they are following the instructions, you could assume that they thought that Mr. Rio didn't know what the procedure was, I really think that he creates a reasonable doubt as on this issue by saying that it was, he very unequivocally said there was offline procedure that was used and that was never explained.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the court. A properly instructed jury concluded that the government had proved all elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant has not met her burden of showing that this finding by the jury was irrational. A defendant causes the use of the mails or the use of the wires when she acts with knowledge that such use will follow in the ordinary course of business or when such use is reasonably foreseeable. In this case, the evidence established that use of the mails, that the defendant clearly knew that use of the mails would follow in the ordinary course of business, or at a minimum, such use was reasonably foreseeable. The entire purpose of this scheme was to obtain proceeds from the Department of Veteran Affairs through the Treasury in response to these fictitious services rendered to her by her fictitious company. The defendant knew that these types of payments were made via electronic transfer because she had vast experience in submitting these types of claims and having these types of claims paid by the VA. For that reason, the defendant and her co-defendant went to a local bank as part of this scheme and attempted to open up a business account for the purpose of receiving these funds by electronic transfer. When that failed, the defendant had her name added to a pre-existing account owned by her co-defendant because she wanted to get the money, and she knew that that money would be electronically deposited into a bank account. In addition to these acts, there was numerous other evidence establishing that she knew that these funds would be electronically transferred.
Well, what about counsel's argument that what's alleged in the indictment in terms of how the actual transfer took place was not really proven? Because Rio says the normal business and practice and custom, which normally that kind of testimony is sufficient for proof.
Well, I disagree with the counsel's summation of the testimony regarding Mr. Rio. Mr. Rio was an employee of the VA at the Hines VA Hospital. He indicated that the first wire, the wire that was alleged to occur on January 16th, occurred, or the VA processed that offline. He said nothing about the August 15th, 2002 payment being processed all offline. Beyond that,
So the August 15th one, which was count two, was in the normal course. That's what you're saying.
By the VA. In addition to that, when Mr. Rio on redirect examination was asked what exactly was meant by the VA processing a payment request offline, he said he didn't know because he was not familiar with that process. Moreover, he indicated that he had no familiarity whatsoever with what the Treasury did and the procedures followed by the Treasury once a payment request was sent to them. Mr. Rio was speaking only to the process by which the VA sent a payment request to the Treasury. is in testimony in no way related to the manner in which the Treasury processed that payment request once it was received. The Treasury employee, Elise Merkley, did testify to that. She indicated that she knew nothing about an offline procedure. She described, in general, the practice followed by the Treasury in processing requests from the VA, and she further authenticated specific records reflecting the transmissions that were charged in the indictment. And
now,
she said,
did she speak to, is that count two that you're talking about?
She spoke to count one and count two, Your Honor. She said that the records reflected that the transmissions charged in both count one and count two had been made in accordance with the general practice followed by the Treasury, and that those records that she was referring to would not have been in the system if they were not accurate and correct. This offline assertion is really a red herring. It simply refers to the manner in which the VA communicated the request to the Treasury, not the manner in which the Treasury forwarded the funds or the payment instructions for the funds to the Federal Reserve Bank for ultimate crediting to the defendant's account. The evidence here is, in the government's opinion, overwhelming. The defendant foresaw or knew there would be a wire transfer, and moreover, if not, certainly foresaw a use of the wires. The level of specificity suggested by defendant is not consistent with the case law in this circuit. She would ultimately require that the defendant foresee the who, the what, the when, the where, you know, the date of every specific transfer. That's not consistent if you look at Alexander, Draymond, Swan.
So looking back at the counts in the indictment, Hyattsville, Maryland was where she submitted her request to the VA? Tell me who Hyattsville, Maryland is. I understand to Dallas, Texas, it's going to the Federal Reserve Bank. Who is standing in the shoes of the Treasury, correct? It's really U.S. Treasury, but going through the Federal Reserve Bank.
Correct. They're allocating the funds,
right,
essentially.
Right.
The Treasury doesn't send funds. They send payment instructions. The process would work such as this. They would submit, the defendant or co-defendant would submit claims to the VA located in Hines, Illinois.
Hi. Okay.
They would then communicate those requests to a VA facility located in Austin, Texas, one that is responsible for handling all requests for payment from the VA. It would then be transmitted to the Treasury, to a mainframe computer of the Treasury in Hyattsville, Maryland.
Okay.
And in fact, as Ms. Merkley indicated at trial, that mainframe handles requests for Treasury facilities all across the country. So just about every Treasury or request for payment from the Treasury is going to go through that mainframe computer. I believe she may have referenced a second one as well. But in any event, once it's sent into the mainframe computer, the payment request is processed. There's various steps that are taken to verify that the request is accurate. And ultimately, once all those processes are followed, the payment instructions are wired from that mainframe computer of the Treasury in Maryland to a Federal Reserve Bank computer in Dallas, Texas.
There's some reason why the government then doesn't make the final leg of the race and talk about the transfer to the bank of the petitioner?
We believe that this was the most foreseeable step in the process. It was the first step. And really, you know, in this day and age,
foreseeable, if you're charging the person with foreseeability, they would foresee that they're going to get the check at their home bank, where they deposit their, or where they have their bank account.
Well, actually, in these types of transactions, they're ACH transactions. There is no actually transfer of funds or wiring of funds. It's settled at a later date.
Yeah.
You know, this is not part of the record, but in this case, for example, the records show that the money would not, in fact, be wired to her bank account or the credit. It would be wired to a computer for, belonging to TCF National Bank in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So I would agree that it is a fairly convoluted process. I mean, certainly, as counsel has indicated, even Mr. Rio had some, you know, misunderstandings about how it worked. But defendant certainly knew that the Treasury would be wiring funds. She knew that because the bank account statements always reflected the Treasury as the source. These payment instructions, in our opinion, were the most accurate description of, you know, those funds being wired, the instructions by the Treasury to the FRB to pay those funds. For those reasons, we would ask that the court confirm the affirm the conviction of the defendant. Thank you.
Ms. Brennan, your time expired, but you may have that minute you requested.
Thank you. Just to address a couple of points that were raised by the appellee. First, he discussed the Rio testimony and said that the most reasonable explanation is to assume that Mr. Rio did not know what was going on with the Treasury and that the offline procedure referred to internal VA procedures. That is not, I think, fairly supported by the record. And I would submit that this is similar to the Swinson case in which they didn't let the jury speculate on to infer foreseeability. In that case, there were a bunch of mailings, and the government contended, and there was one check that hadn't been mailed, and the government tried to say that one particular check that hadn't been mailed was a specific check, and the jury could infer that because it was deposited on the same day that it was issued. Perhaps a plausible explanation, but the court said that wasn't enough, and it wasn't going to let the jury speculate on which check this was, and I think this case is similar to that. If the court has no further questions, we would ask that the conviction be reversed.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, thanks to all counsel. Ms. Brennan, you have an additional thanks on behalf of the court for accepting this appointment and also commending your law firm and ably representing Ms. Tracy Ratcliffe-White. All right, case is taken under advisement.